A virtual classroom with hundreds of thousands of participants who will never meet each other. The professor on a screen, or better still, behind one. Tests graded by other students. It sounds like a dystopian education nightmare. But in 2012, the future of the university has arrived. Radical change is in the air. From the potbangers of Montreal to high-powered thinkers in Silicon Valley, the traditional model of the university is under attack. The digital revolution, which has upended journalism, publishing, movies, and music, is poised to storm the ivory tower. Under enormous financial pressure and facing a strong push to democratize knowledge, the university is being asked to reimagine itself. In question, the very nature and purpose of higher education at a time when demand for it has never been greater. This morning, Ira Basin, our virtual frontiersman, peers into the future and explores what's at stake. Here is his documentary, The Big Disruption, Universities in the Digital Age.
At the University of Wisconsin, where I attended graduate school many years ago, there was a renowned professor of European history named Harvey Goldberg. He was wafer thin, his clothes too big for his body, his thick black glasses too big for his head. You could pass him on campus and pay no attention to him at all. But put him at the front of a lecture hall, get him talking about the Russian Revolution or one of his other favorite topics, and he was mesmerizing.
What is the Russian army in September and October of 1917? It's a huge band of wanderers, men who are deserting in tremendous numbers. There are men who have nothing to eat in the army, who have no shoes to go on the field.
He moved constantly as he lectured, striding back and forth across the stage, an explosion of passion and raw energy. He used no notes, showed no slides, hardly seemed to pause for a breath. But he never stumbled, never lost his way.
In September and in October, there is terrific street action, which is really pillaging, which is rioting, which becomes very headless and very formless. And that pattern is even more indelibly imposed upon the countryside.
About 600 people would regularly attend Harvey Goldberg's hour-long lecture. Few of them were actually registered for the course. The rest of us came for the performance, for the way he forced us to think, and for the thrill of watching a great mind in full flight. And when the lecture ended, usually 5 or 10 minutes after the bell had rung, you heard something you rarely hear after a university lecture: thunderous applause. For me, this was the essence of the university experience: to be inspired, provoked, and challenged, to be part of a community of scholars. For hundreds of years, this has been the magic at the core of the university's appeal. But radical change is now underway. In the words of Stanford University President John Hennessy, there's a tsunami coming in higher education.
So in order to learn about programming, we need to learn new language. This will be a way to describe what we want the computer to do in a much more...
Believe it or not, this may be what the tsunami sounds like. This is a computer science course that I've been taking over the summer. The professor doesn't exactly have the passion of Harvey Goldberg, but that's okay. He might be exciting in person, but I'm taking this course online, so I wouldn't know. I've got more than 100,000 classmates from around the world who I'll never meet. Unlike graduate school, this class is free. The only prerequisite is an internet connection.
So it is starting to look like an Ivy League free-for-all. Top colleges, I'm talking Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, and MIT, are offering free, yes, free, online courses if you can get your hands on a computer.
They're known as MOOCs. That's M-O-O-C. And that stands for Massive Open Online Courses. The term was coined by some Canadian researchers, and in the past few months, they've become a worldwide sensation. And no wonder. Imagine taking a course from a distinguished professor at one of the world's most prestigious and priciest universities without paying a dime.
These very early stages or something so novel, so new, so different is very exciting, at the same time very scary, is potentially disruptive.
Online education for students around the world will be the next big thing in education. This is the single biggest change in education since the printing press.
the biggest change in education since the printing press. The man making that rather extraordinary claim about MOOCs is Anant Agarwal, a computer science professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Go back 1,000 years, you see a professor teaching a class full of 100 or a few tens or hundreds of students. And the professor, you know, talks to the class, writes on a chalkboard, and, you know, gives out homeworks. And students work out the homeworks on paper or whatever, submit them, and you manually grade them. And so the basic premise, the basic mechanism of our courses and classes really hasn't changed dramatically in a big way in, you know, 1,000 years. I think for the first time, we are making a concerted effort to apply online technologies to learning and really and seriously rethinking education in a big way. So I think this is the year of disruption where we are going to really begin rethinking education and reinventing it in a very, very serious way.
Dr. Agarwal is the president of edX, a partnership of Harvard, MIT, and the University of California at Berkeley. It's one of three groups now offering MOOCs to the masses. A second one, called Coursera, was created last spring by a couple of professors at Stanford and now includes 16 universities, including one in Canada, the University of Toronto. And my computer science course is offered by a third entrant in the field, a Silicon Valley startup called Udacity. None of these companies existed at this time last year. They're all taking slightly different approaches, but they share a common objective: to break down the walls of the ivory tower and make a free university education accessible to anyone who wants it. Sound familiar? Talk about a year of disruption in higher education. In Quebec, last winter and spring, thousands of students went on strike, clogging the streets of Montreal and other cities with their pot-banging protests against increases to North America's lowest tuition rates. Their ultimate goal? Democracy in the university. Free education for all.
If we really believe that education is a right, we should demand free education. And free education, of course, is one of many demands that...
Call them delusional, call them unrealistic. Many people did. It is hard to imagine any bricks-and-mortar university in North America opening up its campus to students studying for free. But what if there was no campus? While the Quebec students were out marching, faculty and administrators from some of the world's most elite universities have been developing MOOCs to bring the goal of free university education closer to reality. Daphne Kohler is a professor of computer science at Stanford University. She's also a co-founder of Coursera.
The free part is very important to us at Coursera because there's many people around the world who can't afford even $5 to pay for a course. People have told us, why don't you charge $5? It's the price of a latte. And we say no, because there's kids in Africa and India and Bangladesh who don't have $5, and even more important, don't even have a credit card that they could use to pay for this. And so for us, the fact that education is free is essential because we believe that education should be a right and not a privilege, and that everyone around the world that has the skill and the motivation should be able to learn something that will allow them to make a better life for themselves and their families.
University of the Air. It is with considerable pleasure that the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation presents the first series of lectures in this new program.
The director of MOOCs aren't the first attempt to bring free university-level education to the masses. CBC Radio was a pioneer when it launched University of the Air in 1958.
University of the Air means the beginning of a long-term plan to offer adult education by radio in a wide range of university subjects.
Fast forward 40 years, MIT pioneers a program called OpenCourseWare.
So here they are, the elements of C, RSTU.
Every course offered by the university is available free online to anyone who wants it.
Of course, didn't you all see that? S is, this one's really easy, P1 plus P2.
And many do. They've been used by over 100 million people.
That's clearly how they were chosen. And then U is another tricky one.
Other universities have followed suit. It's an amazing resource, a vast lending library of lectures. I can almost feel like I'm sitting in the classroom, except I can't ask a question, join a discussion group, write a paper, take a test, or get a credit. To do that, I'd have to pay up and enroll at a university that offers some of its courses online. Or maybe a university that offers only online courses.
One university understands how you live today and where you want to go tomorrow. University of Phoenix. Thinking ahead.
In the U.S., the controversial for-profit University of Phoenix boasts an undergraduate enrollment of over 300,000. That sounds impressive, but fewer than 30% actually graduate. A much better option might be Britain's Open University, or Alberta's Athabasca University, a pioneer in distance education since the 1970s. But there are big differences between taking online courses at a university and signing up for a MOOC. The online course will cost almost as much as the classroom version, and enrollment is limited. A MOOC won't cost anything, and classes of over 100,000 people are common. Most traditional online courses try to replicate the classroom experience. They typically feature a professor delivering a lecture. But the people developing MOOCs say online learning needs to be delivered differently. And when it is, it can be better than what you get in an old-fashioned classroom. This, they say, is higher education being reinvented for the internet age. And here's another critical difference between a traditional course and a MOOC. When you complete a course at a university, whether online or on campus, you get a credit that will count towards a degree. That doesn't happen when you finish a MOOC. And that matters because a university degree has never been more sought after than it is today. On average, a Canadian university graduate will earn $1.3 million more during their careers than a high school graduate. And that gap is widening. In today's knowledge economy, it seems you can't get hired for anything without a degree. And there remains an almost insatiable demand around the world for what universities have to offer, the promise of a brighter future. This should be a time of extraordinary growth and optimism on campus. But instead, universities today are facing an existential crisis.
1, 2, 3, set us free!
Their customers are unhappy. Quebec students are not the only ones complaining about higher tuition. All over Europe, students have been taking to the streets in protest. And then there's the issue of student debt, a serious problem in Canada, a major crisis in the U.S.
A ticking time bomb of American debt. This time, all this is owed by college students, $3,000 adding on every second.
American students now owe more than $1 trillion at a time when the job market is worse than it's been in generations. Add to that the overcrowded classrooms, the crumbling infrastructure, and courses taught by low-paid contract instructors rather than tenured faculty with big names and big salaries. And you've got lots of students wondering whether the whole thing is worthwhile. And these are tough times for university administrators, too. They're getting pinched on all sides, facing rising costs at a time of serious government cutbacks. And they're facing something else that they're not really accustomed to: competition. Until recently, higher education has remained largely untouched by the disruptive changes brought on by the digital revolution. But George Siemens of Athabasca University says those days are now over.
We've known for 15-plus years that the internet was happening to large swaths of society. And so we've seen the internet really disrupt the music industry. We've seen dramatic changes to, let's say, even traditional journalism. The internet has transformed the way business is conducted. But in spite of this long curve of the internet happening to many segments of society, many higher education leaders have neglected to prepare the university for this incoming reality. And I think universities were, I think, a little bit arrogant in assuming that, well, what we do can't be done online, right? You know, where there's something so special, so unique about this learning experience on campus, and there is a lot that's very special and unique about it. But the assumption being, well, that's going to be for whether it's for-profit or second-rate universities, but, you know, if we are a prestigious university, our students want to come to us, you know, and have the campus experience. But now that you see MIT, Stanford, Harvard getting into the online space in a big way, I think universities are realizing, wait a second, our assumption of what this medium was, what the internet is, and the limitations of the internet for learning were misplaced. And so now there's definitely a lot of angst in trying to understand how do we react and respond now.
A lot of angst and a lot of questions emerging from the recent arrival of MOOCs. Are they really the next big thing in education? Why are elite universities that don't need the money or the prestige so eager to promote them? Who's going to pay for all this free education? Does the future of the university lie in clicks or bricks? And how does a MOOC work anyway?
So let's get started with programming. And programming is really the core of computer science. Most machines are designed to do just one thing. This is supposed to be a toaster.
Let me tell you about CS 101, the computer science MOOC that I've been taking this summer. It's offered by a California-based company called Udacity, which for now is specializing in math, science, and tech courses. This one promises to teach students how to build their own search engine in as little as 7 weeks by learning a programming language called Python.
And the important thing about Python is it gives us a nice high-level language that we can use to write programs.
They didn't offer courses in building search engines when I was an undergraduate, and if they had, there's no way I would have voluntarily taken one. I'm more comfortable with words than numbers. And here's something else you should know about me. After spending too many years in graduate school, I landed at CBC Radio for a couple of decades. And now I teach courses at 4 different Ontario universities, although not all at the same time. I've taught classes as large as 50 students and as small as 4. I've done lecture courses and seminars. I've overseen online discussion groups. I've even led webinars. And if given a choice between teaching in front of a class or staring into a webcam, I'll take the human interaction every time. So I'm probably not the ideal candidate to succeed in this course, but I'm willing to give it a try. If Udacity can teach me how to write a computer program, it can teach anyone.
Now we're just going to print the number 3, and when we click Run, it will run this code and show us the result down here.
The course consists of dozens of short videos, each around 5 minutes long, each followed by a quiz to see if I'm keeping up. It's astonishingly low-tech. Given the big computer brains behind these courses, I was expecting more bells and whistles. But it turns out this is all by design, the result of some pretty serious thinking about how people actually learn when they're sitting in front of a computer screen. And the inspiration for much of it, the unofficial patron saint of the MOOC revolution, is a most unlikely educational reformer by the name of Salman Khan.
I was an analyst at a hedge fund, and I was in Boston, and I was tutoring my cousins in New Orleans remotely. And I started putting the first YouTube videos up, really just as kind of a nice to have, just kind of a supplement for my cousins.
In 2004, when Sal Khan started helping his cousin with her grade 7 algebra, he was a 28-year-old hedge fund guy with 3 degrees from MIT and an MBA from Harvard.
And as soon as I put those first YouTube videos up, something interesting happened. Actually, a bunch of interesting things happened. The first was the feedback from my cousins. They told me that they preferred me on YouTube than in person. And once you get over the backhanded nature of that, there was actually something very profound there. You have this situation where now they can pause and repeat their cousin without feeling like they're wasting my time.
Before long, thousands of people were watching Khan's videos. One of them was Bill Gates, who started using Khan's videos with his own children. Gates was frustrated that education seemed to be the one field that had remained impervious to technological change. He was looking for someone to lead the revolution. After watching Khan's videos, Gates declared that Sal Khan was his man. The Gates Foundation made a big investment in what became known as the Khan Academy. Its mission? To provide a free world-class education to anyone, anywhere.
And so you can imagine, you know, here I was, an analyst at a hedge fund. It was very strange for me to do something of social value.
Today, Sal Khan is a superstar. He's recorded over 3,300 videos on a staggering array of topics. Want to learn how to convert repeating decimals to fractions? How about a video on patterns of U.S. Cold War interventions? Is biology your thing? There's the always popular taxonomy and the tree of life. They're all available for free on the Khan Academy website, and they're watched by about 5 million elementary and high school students at home and in the classroom every month.
And then they ask us, how long is the rope? So there's a few things you might realize. We're dealing with a triangle here.
A typical video is about 10 minutes long. No 3D, no animation, no multimedia pyrotechnics. You never see Sal on the screen. What you do see is his multicolor markers drawing on a black screen. It turns out that most people learn better if they aren't distracted by a face.
And all that tells us is that the sum of the squares of the shorter sides of the triangle are going to be equal to the square of the longer side, and that longer side is called the hypotenuse.
Khan walks you through the problem in a chatty, sometimes humorous, always non-judgmental way. You can stop and rewind as many times as you like. If you have a question, you can ask it on the discussion board, and you'll usually get an answer very quickly. You can take the quizzes as often as you want, and keep doing them until you get them right. Learn at your own pace and in your own way. No one ever makes you feel stupid when you're learning from a con video.
So R is equal to the square root of 625, which is 25. So this distance right here, the length of the rope, is equal to 25 feet.
Many of Sal Khan's ideas about education fly in the face of conventional wisdom. The assumption has been that face-to-face contact with a teacher is key to learning, and that when it comes to classroom size, only small is really beautiful. So it is hard to swallow the notion that a disembodied voice and some scribblings on a screen might deliver a quality learning experience that's better tailored to the needs of the individual student. But Khan believes online learning can be customized, that teachers can spend less time at the front of the class talking at students and more time talking with them. And there's the added bonus of including millions of people in the mix who previously had no access to education of any kind.
Imagine what it does to a street kid in Calcutta who has to help his family during the day, and that's the reason why he or she can't go to school. Imagine what happens if that student in Calcutta all of a sudden can tutor your son, or your son can tutor that kid in Calcutta. And I think what you'll see emerging is this notion of a global one-world classroom. And that's essentially what we're trying to build.
Sal Khan has inspired a lot of people. One of them is Sebastian Thrun. He's among the world's leading experts in the field of AI, artificial intelligence. He works for Google, where he led the team that developed a car that can drive itself. He teaches AI at Stanford. But after hearing Sal Khan speak at a conference last year, Sebastian Thrun decided it was time to rethink what he was doing with his life.
That really moved me. It made me feel, look, there's this former investment guy who has a million students, and I'm at Stanford having my 200 students. What am I doing with my life? So I decided very spontaneously to say, let's take our class online. I talked to my co-instructor, and he was all excited about it. And we made an announcement, and the announcement wasn't a big media announcement. It was just one email that we sent, a single email saying, hey, guys, you can take Stanford's AI class online for free of charge, and we got the same exams as Stanford students, so you can compare yourself. There wasn't even a promise of a certificate or anything. And that email went viral. So within a day, we had 5,000 students sign up. Next day, 10,000 students. Eventually, it would be 160,000 students.
And so was born the first truly massive open online course. 200 students paying $40,000 tuition at Stanford and 160,000 other people from around the world following online for free. But what those people were offered was not Sebastian Thrun's lectures. Instead, Thrun created a series of Khan-style videos that covered the course material. And then a surprising thing happened. Most of the 200 Stanford students stopped coming to class. They preferred the online version to the lectures.
What we did in the class was very much lecture-based, so you'd lecture the students. And that was good for a few students, but most students sat there, relatively bored, usually a little bit lost. Whereas in the online medium, we organized the entire content very differently. We didn't think about lectures. We thought about quizzing. We all thought about student exercise. So we turned everything around and said, let's make the student work hard and really go through the material. It turns out when students exercise and when they solve problems on their own, they learn better and they feel better. So as a result, almost all my students in class that took this class on physical Stanford's campus and paid tuition for it chose to consume it on video and online using our more quiz-driven exercise. And furthermore, that it's significantly better in the exams.
What Sebastian Thrun had discovered confirms what many educational experts have long observed, that the lecture, the very backbone of university teaching today, can actually be a really ineffective way of learning. Kathy Davidson teaches at Duke University, where she explores the impact of technology on how students learn.
There have been wonderful studies, even people coming out of those TED Talks where they'll ask them in the lobby, did you like the talk? And people say, fantastic. And then professional social science interviewers will ask them about the content of the talk. And it turns out, even in the lobby, leaving a talk you thought was sensational, you only really learn about 20% of the content, and you often have huge variation one person to another. So when learning a skill or learning complex content, it's inspirational, but it's actually not a very effective way of learning even in the moment and retroactively, it's very, very poor in terms of retention and ability to apply it to other situations. Lecturing is one of the worst ways of teaching.
But what about that other staple of university education, the tutorial or discussion group led by the professor or a graduate student? Surely this is where the learning happens. Well, that too is now in question. Studies show that most students are intimidated by the presence of an authority figure in the room. They don't want to sound dumb, so they clam up, and they actually learn better if they're left to just talk things over with each other. And that appears to be true whether you've got a dozen people in a seminar room or 1,000 people in a massive open online course. In fact, the more people involved, the greater your chance for success. That's the view of Athabasca University's George Siemens, an apostle of what he calls networked knowledge. He believes the key to teaching a course with thousands of students is to let them teach each other. And that's exactly what happens when questions arise in MOOCs.
I found that generally within a short period of time, in hours typically, students answer each other's questions. And so if somebody says, okay, I don't understand this, and then a discussion emerges, because you have enough individuals involved, you know, with many people engaged, you know, all questions are easily answered. And the sort of the argument that I would posit is if you have 100 people together, each of these 100 people knows something different than you know, the others as a rule. So the overall knowledge capacity of 100 connected people is quite significant. Even if these are, you know, amateurs in a particular subject area, they can fill a lot of each other's knowledge gaps just by the construction of that particular small group. When you exceed that, or when you make it on a larger scale, you have a far greater capacity for individuals to be able to teach one another, just because each of the individuals in this network have varying levels of expertise and knowledge.
Students teaching students is a key part of the Udacity course that I've been taking on building a search engine. There are dozens of active discussion forums where my classmates help each other with coursework and even language issues. Most of the topics under discussion are too technical to be of much use to me, but one really hit home. What do you do when you feel stuck? Attracted 19 responses. Play some video games was a popular solution.
So we're going to have many quizzes throughout each unit. The point of a quiz is to check that you understand what we've covered. Some of the quizzes will be fairly straightforward, just to see if you...
You can feel the influence of Salman Khan all over CS 101. There are about 60 short videos and lots of quizzes. I see the hand of the professor drawing on a whiteboard, but never his face. The material in this course really is alien territory for me. Even the simplest concepts are a revelation. It isn't long before I start to feel the same kind of brain cramps I used to get when studying math in high school. But I keep going.
So now it's time for your first programming quiz. You've seen enough to be able to write a Python program. And your goal is to write a Python program that prints out the number of minutes there are in 7 weeks. Which is
I'm not looking forward to my first quiz, but when I nail it, I feel good about myself.
Great, you've passed your first quiz. So we're going to continue and do some more complex programs now.
The longer I stay with this course, the more I understand its appeal. Sal Khan might be right. I had 100,000 classmates scattered around the globe, but it does feel like the course has been customized for me. The people on the Udacity team really seem to want to help me succeed and do what they can to break down the isolation of online learning. The professor sends emails encouraging us to keep going, inviting us to join discussion groups, and telling us about meetups scheduled with other Udacians in the cities where we live. Now, I wish I could tell you that this story has a happy ending. It doesn't. I wasn't able to finish my course in building a search engine. In the end, it was too hard for my non-mathematical brain to process. I gave up. And I'm not alone. Only a small percentage of people who enroll in MOOCs actually finish them. But that's okay. It doesn't cost anything. Browsing is encouraged. You get out of it what you want to get out of it, and then move on. I came away from this experience thinking that I may have seen a piece of the future of higher education, and it just might work. And for subjects where there are right and wrong answers, and 100,000 exams can be graded by a computer in the blink of an eye, MOOCs seem to make a lot of sense. But there's more to life and to university than math and computer science. What if I want to take courses in the arts, or humanities, or social sciences? Will MOOCs work just as well there, or do I need to be sitting in a classroom on campus?
Hello,
Welcome to Internet History, Technology, and Security. I'm Charles Severance, and I'll be your instructor for this course.
Charles Severance, who prefers to go by the name of Dr. Chuck, is a professor in the School of Information at the University of Michigan. He's the instructor in the second MOOC, or Massive Open Online course, I've been taking this summer, this one offered by Coursera. I studied history in graduate school, and I'm interested in the history of the Internet. This one should be right up my alley.
And we're going to talk about a highly technical thing, but we're not going to talk from a math perspective, and we're not going to talk from a programming perspective. I mean, really, we're not going to push you on that stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm curious to see how effectively a history course can be taught online. All the history courses I've ever taken require writing essays. But Dr. Chuck can hardly be expected to grade papers from the 43,000 people who have enrolled in this course with me.
Classes offered on Coursera are designed to help you master the material, and you'll be able to learn at your own pace, work on your own schedule, test your knowledge, and reinforce concepts through interactive exercises.
Coursera has only been around since April, but its growth has been phenomenal. Already, more than 1 million people from nearly 200 countries have signed up to take courses. More than 60% of the students come from outside the U.S. The University of Toronto is the only Canadian school in the Coursera partnership. Within 2 days of announcing it would offer 5 Coursera courses this fall in its School of Continuing Studies, more than 30,000 people had enrolled.
So let's talk a little bit about the course. Well, first off, this course is under construction. We are making it as we go. You are the charter members of the awesome Internet History Technology Security Club. And so congratulations and welcome.
This course is scheduled to last 7 weeks. We're expected to spend 3 to 4 hours of focused time per week on the course, and that includes a multiple choice quiz. There will be a final exam, but there's no reading list. That's very unusual in a history course, but it does level the playing field in a class where there are about 15 first languages other than English. I don't envy Dr. Chuck. There are serious teaching challenges here. But Dr. Chuck seems like a knowledgeable, pleasant guy who's trying hard to make this work.
So, please help. We're in this together. I'm the guy that makes the stuff. I'm the guy that kind of creates the game, the dungeon, whatever it is. I'm trying to create this, a place for us to learn together. But it's not mine. It's not all mine. It's yours. So, help me. Give me suggestions on how the course could be better.
My first suggestion? Watch a SalCon video. There's a big difference between online teaching done right and wrong.
And I saw the internet for the first time in the building that's here on this upper left-hand corner of the slide.
Most of the videos are too long and boring. We see Dr. Chuck sitting at his desk showing us slides. We see other geeky-looking talking heads being interviewed by Dr. Chuck. It's hard to stay focused on the content. I now understand why trying to replicate a classroom online doesn't make for a good learning experience.
Now, the key thing is, if you think about that time frame, you know, by early 1990s, things were pretty universal. I mean, we'd gone from, will this happen, to everyone that mattered was pretty much on the network.
To his credit, Dr. Chuck works hard at being accessible. He's been traveling a lot this summer, and wherever he goes, he holds office hours at a local Starbucks, and then he posts the results online.
I'm here at Starbucks right outside New York University, and we're having our first office hours, and I'm going to have everybody say hi and say hi to all the rest of you. Hang on. So say hi to everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
This is a great pleasure to be starting on the new road of education with Coursera. This is going to change the future. We expect to have a lot of fun and intelligence in doing it.
Hearing this kind of enthusiasm coming from some of my classmates is a useful reminder of why MOOCs matter. This course won't help any of them get a job or officially upgrade their skills. This is about learning. Most of the people who've signed up don't have the time, the qualifications, or the money to enroll in a course like this on campus or online. This is their chance to learn from an expert and become part of a community of scholars, however large and disparate it might be. And it's all free. No wonder so many are so eager to embrace the opportunity. But how can anyone measure what these students have actually learned? In week three, Dr. Chuck assigned a 400-word essay. The idea was that we would grade each other's papers. And out of fairness to the non-English speakers in the class, we were instructed not to evaluate writing, spelling, or grammar. But it didn't work. The experiment fizzled, and we went back to doing open book, multiple choice quizzes that could be marked by a computer. Figuring out how to effectively peer grade essays is one of the biggest challenges facing the people developing massive online courses. And until someone finds a way that written work can be evaluated in a meaningful way, I don't see how history, English, philosophy, or a whole range of other subjects can lend themselves to this kind of learning. And here's another big challenge.
When you signed up for Coursera, you basically agreed that you're doing this as yourself, you are who you represent yourself, that you didn't create multiple accounts, and that you're not giving your account to somebody else, you're not letting someone else take a test. And so this is sort of lumped into the notion of an honor code.
Honor codes are great, but hard to enforce in classes of thousands of people. MOOCs have been called a cheater's paradise because there's really no way to verify that was actually me sitting at my computer writing that online exam. But academic cheating is an issue that is not confined to online courses. Listen to what happened at Harvard a couple of weeks ago.
This morning, a cheating scandal rocking Harvard University. Dozens of Harvard students are accused of cheating on a final exam. University officials say they're looking at one class in particular that had more than 250 students in it. They say they found indications that students had plagiarized or shared answers on about half the class's take-home exams.
So you can find cheaters and plagiarizers anywhere in academe, although they're probably easier to catch at Harvard than at Coursera. Daphne Kohler says she takes security problems very seriously, but she doesn't believe that cheating on MOOCs is as big an issue as many critics claim.
I think that it is definitely a challenge, but I think it's a challenge that can and in some ways has already been addressed. There are online programs out there that do some extent offer identity verification and authentication. So one obvious solution is to come in for a proctored final exam, but I think there are other solutions as well that are more technological. I don't think cheating is as ubiquitous as to warrant the name cheater's paradise. Our estimate is somewhere around maybe 5 to 10%, which is higher perhaps than on campus, but not ridiculously higher. And we know that cheating happens in even proctored environments. And so one has to balance out that risk with the fact that you're providing a high quality education to this many people. And I think that most people do this because they actually want to learn. I don't think most people are cheaters.
Most people do want to learn. And when they finish learning, they want to get something to recognize what they've done. But that's not a simple thing for people graduating from massive open online courses.
The certificate thing is still being worked out, and it's really surprisingly complex. Don't do this for the certificate, but I will provide those who achieve my 75% passing score, I will give them an email digital signed certificate that at least will have my name on it. And, you know, stay tuned. We may be able to do more from school.
That not very official email that Dr. Chuck is prepared to send me if I get a 75% in his course will probably never leave my inbox. Why bother wasting the ink to print it? Coursera is still trying to figure out what kind of certificate graduates should get. But the real question is whether those certificates will ever carry any weight. One of the main functions that universities perform is the issuing of credentials. The piece of paper students get at graduation is a signal to employers, a seal of approval. Universities and colleges have long had a monopoly over the issuing of credentials. But now MOOCs want a piece of that action. It would be a huge step on the road to legitimacy if employers began to look seriously at people who completed courses they took for free. Kevin Carey hopes that will happen soon. He thinks everyone would benefit if the higher education monopoly begins to crumble. Kevin Carey is the director of education policy at the New American Foundation, a Washington-based think tank.
It's not enough to know something and to be able to do something. You have to be able to prove it to someone else, and that's what credentials are for. And although Udacity is not allowed to give you a, quote, college credit, as it has been legally defined, because traditional institutions have a monopoly over giving college credits or degrees, they do give you something. They give you a piece of paper, a certificate, a letter, call it what you will, that says the bearer of the certificate took this course, and some of the people experimenting with this will this kind of approach will say, here is the score that somebody got in an exam. Here is where this person ranks compared to the other 100,000 people who took the class. So people are starting to grant what look a lot like credentials. And when institutions start to recognize those credentials for something, that's when I think we'll reach, if not a tipping point, certainly opening up a whole new process and system for higher education that looks very different than the one we're all used to today.
So here's a bit of a Moke paradox. Why is the push for free open online education coming from schools like MIT and Stanford, where standards and tuition are among the highest in the world? One answer is that these institutions and the people who teach there want to be in the vanguard of change. And if massive open online courses are really going to transform education, those schools are going to want to be big players in the game. It's good for the brand. Besides, there may be money to be made one day. Over the past few months, Coursera has raised about $16 million in venture capital money, mostly from Silicon Valley. The company insists it will never sell ads on their site, charge for tuition, make schools pay to use their platform, or sell their massive database to marketers. And that means that finding a way to make money on Moke's is going to be a challenge. Co-founder Daphne Koller says her business plan is still a work in progress, but she sees several possible roads to profitability.
If you build a website that is changing the lives of millions of people, you will find a way to make it sustainable. And that's demonstrated itself multiple times in Silicon Valley in the recent years. But, you know, more concretely, there is the option of charging for certification. Even if people don't pay for the content, it's reasonable to charge a modest amount for a certificate of completion that will allow them to present that to, say, an employer and get a better job. A second model that we're considering is working with employers on employee recruiting. So with student opt-in only, we would be able to allow employers looking to close the skills gap and fill some of those unfilled positions to search against our database for employees with that particular skill set. And that will is a win-win. It's a win for the employers and it's a win for the prospective employees.
Matching students with prospective employers is also part of the business plan at Udacity. It says they already have a list of hundreds of companies, led by Google, who are willing to hire Udacity grads and pay for the privilege. But Kathy Davidson of Duke University isn't impressed. She says when it comes to companies developing massive online courses, you need to follow the money closely.
Right now they're thriving on venture capital and the goodwill of faculty. Faculty are spending tremendous amounts of time making these MOOCs, often because they feel like they have a benefit to the world. That's a great altruistic model, but it's not going to be the prevailing model for a while. At some point, people are going to say, wait, who is profiting and how? And some of the MOOCs are basically employment agencies for Google and other companies who, especially in the classes that teach coding, they're looking for people around the world who will do piecework without security, without benefits, and do code that can be shipped out to the cheapest possible person. Now, that's a cynical version of it. It's not always that cynical, but that is one way they're making money, is becoming basically an employment agency, matching the talented with the employer. And those students might pay a fee in order to be in that pool. So if you've got 160,000 students each paying $50 to be part of an employment pool, that's a lot of money. And you would charge some fee for any successful employment. So there's lots of data that's being mined in the course of your taking a class.
There are a lot of might-bes and could-bes in the world of MOOCs. It's hard to predict the future when it's still being written. But here are a few things we can say for sure. Universities, as we know them, the libraries, labs, classrooms, residences, they're not going anywhere. The on-campus experience is too rich in too many ways, and face-to-face learning too valuable to think that large numbers of students will choose to abandon bricks in favor of clicks. If they had wanted to do that, they could have already moved en masse to online universities like Athabasca. But they haven't. And Kathy Davidson says she understands why.
Why would anyone want to substitute online for face-to-face if what they want is all of the things that come with face-to-face education? I don't think it's a substitute. I think it's a different model. And for some students, especially master students who tend to be older, more mature, already on their career path or looking for a change in a career path, I think online courses are great. But at many universities, all of the things that are involved in an education, our social life, meeting your future mate, which many people say is the single most important thing that's determining success in your life and happiness in your life, making lifelong connections, having the opportunity, if you have good, creative, revolutionary teachers, to take learning into new levels and into new practices, into communities, and applying them in interesting ways. You know, there's so many benefits that come with face-to-face, and there's so many benefits that come with online learning. There are different benefits.
Here's another thing we know. On-campus learning is about to be seriously disrupted by digital technology. Kathy Davison likes to talk about MOATs, massively outdated traditional education. Universities need to be more flexible, she says, in adapting to the different ways that students learn. Do what really works, not what's been done before. We're already starting to see some of the more innovative ideas from online learning make their way into the classroom. Professors creating interactive videos in place of lectures, allowing them to use classroom time for a richer, more individualized learning experience. Coursera's Daphne Kohler says universities will have to continue to adapt and innovate. If they don't, some of them may not survive.
I believe that for a university, any university, to survive, it's going to have to rethink the value proposition that it offers to its students. So a university whose primary value is that it puts people in large lecture rooms and lectures at them, I think those universities are going to have to rethink considerably, and it is going to be a challenge because content is going to become ubiquitous, it's going to be effectively free, and so at that point the only value you're offering to your students is the accreditation. I think there's going to be substitutes for that. So you really need to reformulate the way that you teach in order to offer much more significant value to your students.
MOOCs have only been around for a few months, and they've generated a lot of attention. But although they've grown very fast, very quickly, their survival is by no means assured. Their to-do list is long and difficult. Improve quality, broaden the range of courses, figure out a way to test what students have learned, develop a viable business model, solve the security issue, and convince prospective employers that a MOOC graduate is worth hiring. But even if all those issues get resolved, there are still serious limitations to online learning that won't go away. Indira Samarasekara is the president of the University of Alberta.
It's an exciting form of information delivery. And that's what it is, right? An exciting form of packaging content. So rather than somebody reading a textbook or sitting in a classroom hearing a lecture, they get a very interesting experience using web-based tools online. But it is very far away from us saying this person has received an education, or even being able to assess whether an individual is now skilled in the subject that they've been exposed to simply through online lectures.
Indira Samarasekara appreciates the fact that online courses open the doors of higher education to millions of people who previously had no access. Everyone celebrates that. But she's not yet ready to see her university jump on the massive open online bandwagon. She believes there's a lot more thinking that needs to be done.
Who knows, in 200 years, maybe this discussion will be moot. But where we are now, we must not. While we get caught up in the hype and the excitement and the possibility of online education, we must not forget to continue to center on the debate of what constitutes an education. How do you create individuals with that global mindset, with critical thinking skills, with creativity, with language capabilities? We shouldn't walk away from that.
Because you have to begin with not universal suffrage. Women do not vote. Agricultural workers do not vote. Workers in factories with less than 50 workers do not vote. Migrant workers do not vote. The whole thing, you see, was simply trickery.
Remember Harvey Goldberg, my silver-tongued professor from back in graduate school? He died many years ago, so I have no way of knowing what he would think about massive open online courses. I'm guessing he would be pleased with the fact that MOOCs have made higher education more democratic and more global. The virtual part would probably simply confound him. At one or two points in every lecture, Professor Goldberg would pause and say, "What I want you to think about," and you knew that something interesting, possibly even profound, was about to be said. So let me try that. What I want you to think about is this. Every time Udacity or Coursera or edX have announced a new MOOC over the past few months, tens of thousands, sometimes even hundreds of thousands of people all around the world have rushed to sign up. What does that tell us? I think it tells us that in today's world, there's an insatiable appetite for more knowledge and more skills. We're all students all the time. And our current system of higher education is simply incapable of addressing those needs. Our universities are too expensive, too restrictive, and too inaccessible. And when governments try to deal with the problem through more student aid or more online universities, they're simply tinkering at the edges. Which is why we all owe a debt of gratitude to the people who, over the past few months, have been boldly bringing free online education to eager learners all over the world, who have challenged us to think about radical new ways of learning, both in the classroom and online. People like Sebastian Thrun, who gave up a high-paying job at Google and invested lots of his own money to start Udacity. I'm pretty sure Harvey Goldberg would have approved.
It's very hard to compare these things. I mean, there's many things that are really important, global warming and climate research, energy and so on. But education is the thing that enables people. And yet this thing called education is so inaccessible today. And it's getting actually more inaccessible, at least in the United States, to escalating college costs. But it's inaccessible in Germany. It's inaccessible in South Africa. In most of the developing world, it's really hard to get high-quality education. I think if you can open the door to better education and make it accessible, which to me means also free, we can fundamentally alter the speed at which humanity progresses. I can't imagine a better thing to put my personal time into than that.